Confusion was because I was telling people it was Tuesday or Wednesday. I thought I was going back. It turned out it was actually Friday. So that's what happens when you live overseas. You don't go to work every day. You kind of lose track of the date and what day it actually holds out to be. Dale asked me if I'd share a little bit about Bangladesh. I know some of you are on my WhatsApp updates, so some of this will be a quick rerun of that. And then about a day later, I think it was, Dale messaged me back, and he's like, do you mind just like maybe sharing something else to fill out the rest of it? I think Dale was remembering how I usually go over time when I talk, so he decided to just go ahead with it. And I agreed to it. There's a couple of things that have been on my mind, not just in the last couple of months, but as last couple of years of my life, and it really played out, I think, really intensely over the last 2 months being in Bangladesh, so I'll be going into that. So I got a couple of pictures I want to show you all just a little bit of Bangladesh and what I've been doing there. So this is an idea of what the camps look like that we are in. There's three main camps that everybody is in. The numbers that we have heard are around 1.1 million people. That's the actual biometric. They're doing biometric scans of the eyes when they come in, so that's a fairly accurate number. There's three main camps. This is the largest camp that this picture was taken in. This is actually in the part of the camp that I'm authorized to work and do different things in. It's just in my small part of the camp is 60,000 people. That I'm drilling wells and doing that. We're building bathrooms and shower houses is what we're working on. This is just as far as you can see, pretty much in a 360 degree turn, this is what you'll see. I was on a little bit of a ridge overlooking, and it's just houses and houses and houses, and they're just, you know, tight against each other. So you can imagine the situations that arise from that. The other thing that we're doing there is drilling wells. This picture is slightly distorted because I was taking the opposite way on my phone, but their way of drilling wells and ours are slightly different. But they set up this little pyramid here, and they put their pipe up in the middle, and basically somebody walks in a circle all day just spinning this thing. And they're injecting water down the pipes. That helps kind of push the dirt and sand, whatever it is, out of the way of the bottom. I asked them what happens if they hit rock. They said, well, they do have a drill bit, they called it. I'm not sure how that worked exactly, but yeah, they would just walk in a circle all day long, spinning this pipe. And we're on a bit of a hill. That was the problem because they were saying there's no drinking water available. What happened in the beginning when the refugees would have, like the influx, they call it, in August of last year, what kind of happened was there was a lot of donors came in, threw a lot of money at some Bangladeshi well drillers and said, here, drill some wells. Well, Bangladesh is number one, number two on the world corruption list, so you can imagine what happened there. They pocketed the money, drilled a well about 30, 40 feet deep and said, oh, there's water, we're good, and then they went on to the next one. And it was supposed to be 500 feet deep. So they were just pocketing the money, and there's a lot of wells now all over camp, but they're not good. I mean, they only go down 30, 40 feet. They're enough to wash clothing, wash, you know, you can take a shower in it, but you're not drinking that water. And they're right next to latrines. They're right next to the last picture you saw, that little pool of water in the middle there. You don't really want to get in that pool of water. You know, that's where their wells are right next to, and so you can imagine the issues, the diseases that they're concerned about that are possibly going to rise. So this well was up on top of a hill away from all that, and we're expecting 500-600 feet, and we hit good water at 560 feet. And so these guys are spinning a pipe 560 feet long down into the ground. So it, after a bit, it takes 2-3 of them to spin that pipe. Once they've got it down, here they were just installing, like they call it a filter, the white pipe. You can see the guy holding there. They were heating it up with just an open flame, and there's a gray pipe to the left there that he was going to put on the top and glue it together. You can see a lot of the kids were gathering around. This was great news to them. They were excited about it. We kept asking some of them, how far are they going for water? How far are you going for drinking water? Well, some were saying, well, they walk an hour one way. That's what a lot of them were saying. It's hard to know exactly how far it is, and they were telling us, well, there's one well this way and there's one well the other way. They're trying to regulate their different wells they go to. They're afraid the other wells will run dry. So they were pretty excited about the wells that we were drilling. And then this was our contractor who had dug the well and was in charge of it, was making sure that I was happy with the end product. There was water coming out. He was showing me that. And then once the ground would dry and settle a little bit, we're going to build a platform around that concrete platform to give them a stable spot to get their drinking water from. We're also going to start into latrines and showers once I'm back. I have a translator and a guy that's working for us right now who is there. When I left, we had four officially done. They were all over 500 feet deep, roughly, give or take some, but that was the depth that it seemed like they were hitting water at. And we had fixed three other wells that were there and dug, and they were good. They just were broke. Something was wrong with them, and the refugees have no cash to fix them. So we were able to just fix a couple, which is a much easier fix if we can do that. And then, like, the bathrooms, they're just a mess everywhere. And so there's a lot of them that need to be. We're building new ones, as well as decommissioning the old ones, as they call it, which is basically not a lot of fun, but there's nobody wants to do it, so there's a lot of that around. There's a lot of these full toilets that are just sitting there, and they're worried about the rainy season that's coming in about June, July. They're expecting a lot of that stuff's going to start, you know, filling up with more water, and then it's going to start washing all over camp. And so they're asking for people to come in and be able to, you pull the concrete rings up that are in there, and then dump a bunch of lime and cover them up with dirt and put a marker, so they say it's going to be a little spongy for a month or two. And so that's what we're going to tackle when I get back in about a week. So I'm not exactly looking forward to that part of it, but no one else wants to do it, so that's why we go do those things. Some of the opportunities that we've very quickly ran into, I mean, the first month it was kind of frustrating because there's a lot of waiting for paperwork, a lot of shaking hands and drinking tea, and something that I'm not a big fan of. I'd rather just go get dirty. And for the first month, a little over, was just a lot of meeting people and talking to people. And this is one of the opportunities that we got into. There's a couple guys that had come over with me, and we were just walking around looking at, you know, well locations. And this is what they call a madrasa. It's basically, it's a mosque school where they teach the kids Arabic, and it's a requirement in Bangladeshi law that they also teach not just the Quran, but they also teach them, you know, general math and that kind of thing. We happened to walk in right when they were teaching English, so that was a perfect scenario for them. And we took over for about an hour and just taught rough, you know, numbers and colors and things like that, and made it a lot of fun. And they were asking us right away, well, can you send people over to teach English for us? That was one of the big needs, and you always have that pretty much any country you go to, but that was one of the first things they asked about. One of the guys that had came over plays spike ball rather professionally here in the U.S. He's actually considered a world-ranked player. He was over there with us for about 3 weeks, and so he brought a spike ball set along, and we set it up in the one refugee camp, and we drew a very large crowd quickly. And believe it or not, I mean, I've played spike ball a few times more just for fun, but my friend Josiah, he was playing very, very chill so the rest of us could actually keep up with him, but it didn't take long. The refugees, they caught on to this game. This looked like a lot of fun, and so we would slowly step out and put one new guy in. We'd play a little bit, another guy would step out, another new guy would come in. And after a bit, I think there was two sets we had over there. We had two sets set up, and these guys were playing, and they were yelling at each other, like chewing each other out, like, man, you didn't do that right, you got to do it this way. And they caught on, like, instantly to this game, and it was a big deal. We were there for a couple hours just doing this, and you'd see other people come over and try to get them to go do. They were supposed to be doing something else, but they were playing with us instead. But it was interesting, just the opportunity to be able to hang out with these people and to, you know, have a little more fun with them. You hear some of the stories that they've gone through and they've had to deal with. It's cool to be able to see them get out and have fun. Just the stories of coming across the river in water tanks, so they cut the top off, and they just pile people in as long as it would still float, and they were floating across the river that way. Small little boats. Some of the Bangladeshis were running these little canoes, basically, across the river to get them. And this river isn't just like something you'd swim across either. It's a fairly large river. And just stories like that. One man that I met, he was one of the first nights in, or first days in camp. We met him, and we were just, you know, say, hey, you know, we're here to try to figure out how we can help. What can we do? And you know, of course, one of the first things they go after is, well, can you help us with our situation, the citizenship issue that we have? Well, no, I probably can't do anything about that. But what can I do about your living situation? But he was telling us about Myanmar, what was going on there. And he was telling us how that his four sons were lined up right in front of him. They were all shot right there in front of him as he had to stand there and watch this happen. What do you tell somebody like that? You know, he was about 65, I would have guessed. What do you tell someone like that when they tell you a story? And it's just, so you just kind of stand there like you don't even know what to do or say. And like anything, well, here, I'm here to help you with water. I mean, what do you tell a person like that? That was a struggle I really had, because you kept hearing stories like this. And they would pull up photos or videos on their phone and show us of some of this stuff happening. And it's like, They actually have video footage of, you know, their friends and children and stuff getting beat and shot. And but this is life. That's what that's why they're here. That's why they're willing to live house against house in about a 3,000-acre area, 600,000 people in just that one area. Because they're fleeing something a lot worse than that. They'd rather live door to door with each other than deal with that situation. I think that's the last of the photos I had. But yeah, that's kind of what the last 2 months of my life has looked like. Like I said, I'm going back on Friday again to continue developing the programs that we're trying to get going there. And we have a few people coming over that are, one of them is looking to stay longer. He's hoping to be able to take my position there and carry on the project longer term. And so you can pray for that as I go back. And as we continue to work there, Bangladesh is not necessarily the easiest place in the world to live. At least I didn't think so. Definitely challenged me in a lot of ways. I told some people they come back, oh, it's probably safer in Iraq and stuff. Well, yeah, but I'd still rather be in Iraq than I would Bangladesh, but personal opinion. But some of the things that I was challenged with over the last 2 months over the last couple of years that really came out the last 2 months were do the little things. You know, you talk about a refugee camp of that size, that many people, like, where do you start? What do you do? And I think that's what really got me down about a month in. I was just like, I don't want to go home. Like, this is crazy. I don't know what to do here. Like, we had paperwork after paperwork, and it felt like nobody really cared. Oh, yeah, we need people here, but it felt like all they wanted was your money. They didn't really care about anything else. And it was getting really frustrating to me. And one day, I was walking into camp. I was on the phone talking to somebody from the organization back here. And I was pretty frustrated, and I was telling them, like, I think we just need to basically pack up and leave. Like, I mean, there's needs here, but it's not like it's emergency situations. There's like another 100 or so NGOs. There's lots of NGOs there doing work. Like, why are we here? Like, this isn't what PCCR does. We're lifeboat situation. We're like when stuff's really going south. That's what I get excited about. And you know, they're trying to calm me down, but they're like, it's not, you know, give it a little more time. But that morning as I'm walking in, I'm on the phone, I'm talking. There happened to be this little girl going up. The path into camp is a pretty good hill up on top, and it's, you know, it's rutted out from the rain and just from people walking on it. And the distribution centers are out along the main road, out on the edge of camp, where they hand out food, clothing, and that kind of thing. And they have some of them have a pretty good walk to get to the distribution center. So this little girl, I'd guess, her between 8 and 10 years old, she's carrying a bag of rice, and she's got it propped on her hip, and she's wandering up this hill. And I'm on the phone, I'm frustrated, I'm trying to follow her. I was trying to get ahead of her, but somehow she kept picking her way up this hill and, like, kept getting in my way every time I tried to go around her. She had no idea I was back there. She would just, like, step over, and she was obviously picking the easy path, and so was I. But, you know, and there's people coming down this slope, and they're a lot of older men, so they don't care about anybody else. They're just going for it. And I finally, like, I got off the phone. I was kind of frustrated, and I just kind of looked up, and it hit me right like that. Like, here's something small I can do. I can't start digging wells. This is before we were digging wells yet. Like, I can't do that. But here's a little girl who's struggling up this hill. I can carry her bag for her. So I asked the translator to tell her this, and she, right away, she did the customary Bangladeshi thing. Well, like, no, like, I'll take care of this. You can't help me. And he insisted, and so she turned and gave the bag to me, and up the hill we went. And, you know, it wasn't that heavy for me. I mean, it was maybe 40 pounds or something, but, you know, she was struggling with this thing. And the further I walked, the more I noticed that she was getting closer to her. I could tell. I mean, I didn't know where she lived, but I could tell we were getting closer just by the reactions from the folks sitting around. Like, as we got closer, you'd see them kind of like they recognized her, and they realized that, what's this white guy following her carrying a bag of rice for? And they would kind of grin, and they would kind of like ask her what she's doing, because, you know, Islamic culture is not really okay with a guy doing a woman's job, especially not a little girl and some foreigner doing her, you know, her job. And so they were like giving her this little look like, you know, what are you doing? And as I got closer yet, some of the children, I don't know if they were siblings or cousins or just neighbors there, they would, like, totally stop playing and look at me and kind of poke each other and grin. And I realized that she made one turn. She was enjoying this, too, because she had her head down real hard, and she has this really sly grin on her face, and she just looked back, see if I'm still back there. And we went around these turns, and as I kept walking back into where her house was, I was like, this is getting crazy. Like, their house is right on the edge of a cliff. And I come around the corner, and there was a house wall. Literally, the path was about as wide as this little podium is. And there's a 6-foot drop down to the roof of another house. And she makes this turn like nothing, and she's trucking around. I come around the corner holding this bag, thinking, okay, this is going to get a little tricky. I'll just hold it out the side. And all of a sudden, there's three little children walking towards me, too, right in the middle of this path, and they have nowhere to go either. And she just darts right around them, and I'm, okay, this is going to get even more fun. And they hug the wall, and I squeeze around them, and just like that, I saw there's some steps that just dropped right down into a house, right into the front door of this house. And so I don't understand the language a lot. I mean, I'm catching words now, but I knew that there was some exclaiming going on because the girl was ahead of me a little bit. She dropped down in the house, so her job was to go get this rice and come back. Well, she shows back at her house with no bag of rice, so her mom was like, "No, what are you doing? What's going on?" I mean, I don't know if that's exactly what she said, but that was the idea. And even before the little girl could reply, suddenly in their 4-foot-high door, some foreigner just popped in and dropped a bag of rice at her feet, and the mom was sitting there, and all of a sudden she just like looks up at me, and her eyes got big. She gets up and stands back, and I just said bye and turned and went back out the door. As I'm walking away, I just hear this chattering and giggling and carrying on back there as I went around the corner. And I talked to our translator later, and he's like, "Oh," he's like, "you guys, when you all leave this camp," he said, "whenever you decide you're done here," he's like, "you guys will live on in their minds forever." He said, simply because, he said, "yeah, you're a white face for number one," but he said, "two," he's like, "the other white faces here in the camp, the other NGOs," he said, "they don't work. They don't get out and do anything. They come in their trucks, they get out, they tell people how to do things, they leave." He said, "you guys actually come out, walk the street or the streets, and do things." And so it's just that little thing. It was a real good reminder for me to focus on the little things. And just another little story. Well, I mean, Matthew 10:42, it refers to, you know, if you give a cup of cold water to somebody in Jesus' name, how you can, you're blessed for that. And I had to think, oh, a cup of cold water. I'm drilling a well of water. That should be great, right? But just simple things like that, that God is asking us to do, those little things. Luke 16:10 says, "He who is faithful in little things can be trusted with greater things." I'm there working in the camp trying to get permission for greater things, and I'm struggling, I'm frustrated, and God's sitting here going, "You're missing all those little opportunities right in front of you all the time." And just another story, I'm going to talk a little bit about a video that I have watched years ago and has always stuck with me, but I was trying to find that video last night. I was going to show it, and I decided it's a little longer than I wanted to play, but I found another short video that really stuck with me, kind of back this idea of doing the little things. And it was about a fireman who said, he's a volunteer fireman up close to New York City, and I don't know the whole backstory to it, but he just said that him and some of his friends, they used to like rush out to these scenes because they were volunteers. So he says, we were kind of the last ones allowed to go do the cool stuff, you know, the fun hero type stuff. And he said, you always would rush out to these scenes and try to be the first one there so you could be the chosen first to go in or help and do whatever. And he said one night, they got a call in the middle of the night, and he said it was perfect. He said, I took off, and he was there, and he said, I got there thinking I'm the first one. I show up, I'm the second one by about 5 seconds. So he said, oh, great. He has to wait in line now to be able to do anything cool. And he said the captain waves him over, and he tells the first guy, listen, the lady's standing out here. We need you to go back in the house, and her dog is, and he told her exactly where the, told the guy exactly where the dog, the dog was in the house. He thought, oh, great, a dog. Like, come on, like, that's a perfect way to be a hero to somebody, like save a dog. Like, so he's kind of bummed out about this. And so that guy goes and does his thing, and he's waiting, and the captain says, well, he said, listen, your job, he said, since you're the second one on the scene, he said, the lady's staying out here. It's raining. She has an umbrella, but she needs a pair of shoes. Go in the house, get her a pair of shoes. So he said, I walk off thinking, great, a pair of shoes. Like, who cares? So he said, I go in the house, get the pair of shoes. I'm coming back out. He said, I'm passing all the real firemen who are doing the real work. He said, here I'm carrying his shoes. I come out with the same guy that that has the dog. He said, I get there. And of course, he said, the dog got all the attention. She didn't really care about the pair of shoes. He said, he went home thinking, oh, well, whatever. He did his thing. 2 weeks later, he's at the fire hall, and the captain is reading a letter this woman wrote to the fire hall. And she's thanking them for their service and their duty and all these things that they've done for him. And she's like, especially thanks to the guy who brought me even a pair of shoes when I needed it. It might have taken her a little while to realize what she really appreciated that night. And so his point was, don't wait until, he was talking to a business conference kind of when he gave the speech, but he said, don't wait until something big, like you have $1 million or you have all this money piled up and now I'm going to give, now I'm going to help somebody. He's like, look for those little things now. If you won't do it now, you're not going to do it later, most likely. And to add on to that, is the thought of how bad do you want it? How bad do I want it? So when I was, a few years ago, when I was a little bit younger, around 18 or so, I got to playing hockey. And I had never really played hockey much before I was 16. It was kind of a new thing for me. And I started playing and decided this was something I really enjoyed. And so it didn't take me long to figure out that I was a little undersized. I was a little slower than a lot of the guys. I didn't have the experience they did. And so I knew that I'm going to have to do something to be able to keep up with this hockey thing. And so I started watching YouTube. I found videos how to skate faster, how to skate harder, how to shoot better, shoot harder, trickier. Everybody wanted to play offense when I was younger. It was the cool thing. And so I was like, well, we always need a defensive player. So I said, well, I'll play defense. And so I was studying how to play defense. And, of course, I was a little bit littler, and defense usually gets pretty rough. And so I thought, well, I got to learn how to use my small size to my advantage. Same as when I play football with Jason and some of the guys. I'm a little smaller, so I got to figure out smarter ways to play. And so I was going through all these things, trying. This is what I wanted. This is what I wanted to do. I wanted to be good at hockey. I wanted to be able to keep up with the guys. And so I found this video some time ago, and it's always stuck with me. It works for a lot of places in life, but it was kind of toned toward hockey at that point. But it was called How Bad Do You Want It? And this young man, he wanted to be successful. He just really wanted to be successful in life. And so he went to this guru and said, hey, I want to be like you. Like, you're successful, you're excellent. I want to be just like you. So the guru said, all right, well, that's fine. Meet me at the ocean tomorrow morning. So at 7 a.m. So 7 a.m., he shows up, and he's thinking, all right, he's in his business suit and tie. He's ready to go. And the guru says, walk out into the ocean. He thinks, all right, this is pretty crazy, but fine. So he walks out in the ocean. He's up to his knees, and he's, can I stop? No, I'll go a little further. So the guru kind of follows him out into the ocean, and as he gets up to his waist, he's like, this guy is crazy. Like, I'm in a suit. What am I doing in the ocean? And he keeps telling him, no, go a little further. He said, he's out to his mouth. He's bound up to his chin. He's like, man, this guy's successful, but something's wrong with him. He is absolutely crazy. He's making me do this. And he's starting to kind of argue with the guy. And he's like, listen, how bad do you want it? Do you want to be successful? Yeah, he wants to be successful. Go out a little further. So it starts getting up over his mouth and his nose, and the guru just kind of grabs his head and shoves him under the water and holds him there. And of course, if that happened to you, what would you do? You start thrashing around, same as this guy did, and flailing his arms. And finally, the guru lets him back up, and the guy he's going for the shore. And the guru says, stop, where are you going? He's like, I want to be successful, but this isn't helping me at all. He's like, what did you want more than anything when you were under the water? You wanted air. You wanted to breathe. He said, you're not going to be successful in life unless you want it as bad as you want to breathe. If you've ever had asthma or know of somebody who's had asthma, you've watched kind of the effects of that. There's nothing more at that moment they want than air. They don't care about what's on Instagram. They don't care about what's for dinner later. They're concerned about getting that next breath of air. How bad do you want it? How bad do you want to be successful? What are you striving at being successful in? And for me, and I think it applies to everybody in the room, but there's points in our lives, whether we're in it now or we will be later, but there's points in our lives where there are things in our life they're getting in our way of being successful. When I talk about being successful, I'm not necessarily talking about financially, but that's a part of life, but I'm talking about successful in our walk with Christ. How bad do we want it? Most of us will say we want it. That's the right thing to say in church or anything, anywhere else, kind of, but do you really? What are you willing to give up? Are you willing to give things up for the sake of being successful with Christ? Are you willing to look a little silly doing things in an effort to be successful with Christ? I can look at my life because that's what I'm most familiar with, obviously, but there's definitely things that I look back on that I've had to walk away from simply because it wasn't going to help me in my walk with Christ, at where God's taking me. Not that those things were bad, they were good things. I had the opportunity to start a roofing business and things like that. There was things that I would have really liked to do, but God said, no, I got something else for you. And there could be a lot of different things that can get in the way of what Christ is asking us to do. Matthew 10, 37 through 39 says, whoever loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. We read those verses all the time. To die is gain. Do we really believe those verses? They're easy to say, but they're a bit harder to live out. Like I was referring to earlier, there are so many things, good things in life, that can pull our attention away from Christ. We sang that, actually before I get into that, so sometimes God calls us to do things we really don't want to do. Part of that following Christ. And that's one of those things that I'm stuck in right now. You know, Bangladesh is great, but I felt for a long time that I'm being called into something bigger with Plain Compassion and where we're going with there and a project that we're trying to start. And one of those things, the requirements of that project I'm learning is being medically trained somehow. I have no desire to be medically trained. I don't want to have anything to do with the medical field. I want to stay out of it. But I don't really feel there's any way around it at this point. I feel like God is calling me into this. And so I signed up for an EMT class in California in June. And I got my book in the mail the other day that I'm supposed to study. And I'm going, why am I doing this? I got a professional CPR test that I was supposed to do on Saturday, yesterday. And I was doing too many other things throughout the week, and I got up to about Friday night, and I started chickening out, saying, this is crazy, I don't have time for this. So I pushed it off till Thursday, so we pushed it off a little further. But as I'm going through that test, I'm doing all these different scenarios you're supposed to go through on how to administer CPR and your AED stuff, and I'm just going, God, why do you have me in this? I have no desire to do this. I just don't. But God's saying, there's something else that I got for you, and this is part of that plan. You need it. You're going to need it for down the road. And so there I am, doing something I don't really want to do, taking a lot of time doing it as well. And it was pretty cool how Matt led the song this morning. You know, here's my heart, Lord. Speak what is true. And as I was standing back there, it's an older song. I've known it for a long time, and it's easy to sing. When you stop and actually think about the words you are singing and what you are saying, makes you almost want to stop sometimes, don't it? Here's my heart, Lord, speak what is true. What is God calling you to do? And is there anything getting in the way? Everybody's at different spots in their life, here at home, in the community that we have church here, the school here, your family, that kind of things. Not one thing is better than another, but what is God calling you to do? Are you going into what God's calling you to do all the way? Or are you holding back because, well, there's something else you'd rather be doing? Another story that was told to me some time ago, and I've always appreciated it, was life is kind of like a, I think I've used this here at church before, but I'll say it again. Life is kind of like a never-ending escalator going downhill. There's really no stopping and just cruising. You can stop, but you start going downhill. That's just the way it goes. So to be successful in your walk with Christ, it's going to take some effort. It means you're going to have to turn around that escalator, and you're going to have to make effort and run uphill, ignoring all the angry glances from everybody else that's going downhill. And sometimes life is a lot like that. Sometimes even your friends are those people that you have to run by, because they're pretty comfortable where they're at, and they're enjoying it. And you're kind of rocking their ride. Are you going to keep on going where you're supposed to go? Or are you going to let them get in the way? We are, in a lot of ways, designed to be fighters. And by that, I mean, it was a few months ago, my family was together at the cabin, and I was talking to my oldest brother about it. And I said, I just came back from a meeting with Plain Compassion at the time, and it was right before I was deciding where I was going to go with life. And I came back from him, I was kind of frustrated, and I just told him, I said, I'm so tired of, how do I say this? I said, I'm so tired of everything I get involved with, or anywhere I go, things I do that it's a fight. I said, work, I said, the mission field, church, relationships, just everything. Everything's a fight. You know, there's no, I just want to roll into a situation and be like, it feels good to be here. Let's just hang out here for a while. That's just not how it's been. And my brother kind of looks at me with a little smirk on his face. He goes, well, that's not who you are. You're not designed to be that way. He said, I don't think as men, for number one, we're designed to be that way. But he says, as Christians, we're not designed to be that way. We're supposed to fight. We're supposed to fight for our families, friends, those around us that we are involved with. Another song that we often sing, I want to end with, very real common. I have decided to follow Jesus. No turning back, no turning back. Though none go with me, still I will follow. No turning back, no turning back. The cross before me, the world behind me. No turning back, no turning back. Let's pray. God, thank you so much for this opportunity that we have to be here together as a church and to worship and to grow in you. God, you know where each one of us is in our walk with you, where we're going, where we're at, and the difficulties that lie ahead. I just pray, God, that you would draw each one of us closer to you, show us the way. God, if we're not strong enough to see the whole way, that you would just give us the strength for the steps ahead for the next day, the next week, the steps that we can take, and that we just keep being drawn closer to you and keep walking in the direction that leads to you. Thank you for everything that you do for us each and every day. Thank you for the way that you provided for us in this country more than I think we'll ever really know. And I just pray you continue to guide and direct us, help us not to take our freedoms and just the blessings that we have in this country for granted. And I ask this all in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you, Sean, for sharing. I was a lot of things going through my mind that you shared that are amazing and are true and are part of reality. And the thing of a big thing is it's easier to say than do. It's very easy to say we will do things. It's a lot harder to actually walk them out. And I loved your elevator illustration, by the way. Never heard that before, but I connect with that. It's accurate. That's how it is in reality. And if we just stop and do nothing, we'll go down. The elevator will take us down. So thank you for sharing. The other thing that spoke to me too was just the big picture that you're seeing. Even some of the stories, some of the things you shared this morning, didn't just happen. Aren't just a something that happened in one day. There's something that you're seeing throughout your life, and so you're seeing some bigger picture. And God is about big picture. God sees the big picture. And I think a lot of times for myself, and it's so easy to just get caught up in the here and now, and everything's about us in the next 10 minutes, in the next day or week, and God's saying, wait a second, I want you to go through this because I'm seeing this as the end. And so I'm hearing that this morning as well. So bless you for sharing. And because I was reminded as well, yesterday, me and my wife watched the I Can Only Imagine movie, which is really good. I would recommend that if you have time. If not, take the time. And that song wasn't written in 10 minutes. That song is a description of someone's life, literally, years and years and years. And of what he went through, and then, coming and writing that song. And I think that's why that it's so powerful. It's, years and years of something, and then he wrote a song about that. And I'm hearing that from Sean this morning as well. So this is, stuff takes time. It doesn't always happen in 10 minutes. So bless you, Sean, for that. We're going to keep moving here this morning.